This is 100.3 Sound FM, CKMS, Radio Waterloo. This is the Aleem Show with Talkative Aleem here. Today's stories that we have here, 50 Good Samaritans on train help refugee family navigate new country. So we're going to start off with that first. When a Canadian woman offered to help a refugee family, appearing lost and confused at a train station, little did she know she'd just be one of 50 people coming to their aid. Valerie Taylor was on her way home when she spotted the family in Toronto's busy Union Station. The Syrian family, a mom, dad, and 6 kids, one of whom was disabled, was trying to make their way through the busy terminal. They had 2 baby strollers, several large bags, and only one member, an 11-year-old boy who spoke any English. He explained to Taylor that they had only been in Canada for 4 months and were trying to get to a town 50 miles away to visit relatives, but didn't know what train to take. Taylor, going in the same direction, offered to lead them to their platform. After they were underway, Valerie found the family actually meant to go to another town, London, Ontario, 60 miles further away and on a different line. Suddenly, passengers started pulling up train schedules on their phones, looking for the best connections to get family where they needed to go. Valerie spoke with an employee of the GO Transit Railroad, who figured out a connection, but the transfer would cost a family a few hundred dollars. More money than they had. The strangers rallied to help, taking up a collection of pay for the transfer. Valerie got off the train with the family to help buy the tickets, but as she was entering their information to a ticket kiosk, another passenger ran up telling her not to buy the tickets. The railroad was sending a bus to take the family to their destination, but when they realized that would take a long time and one of the children was disabled, they put the family in a couple of taxis for the last leg of their trip. Valerie said she was overwhelmed by the number of good deeds performed by perfect strangers in a matter of a few hours. "It was really quite amazing," she told CBC News. It was really just groups of random strangers coming together to just do the right thing and help this family connect with their relatives for the weekend. Awesome kindness. Keep up the great work. Proud to be Canadian. Now I have some other stories that we can talk about as well. Owl flies into moving car, breaks both wings, but carrying people save the day. This is an amazing story of an owl that flew straight into the window of a moving car. Not only did he and the driver miraculously survive the accident, but after breaking both wings, the owl became a surrogate parent in the Hospital for Orphaned Owlets before he was finally released back into the wild in the backyard of the very man whose vehicle he collided with, all thanks to a caring community of rehabilitators and volunteers. Most of us have experienced the sick feeling when an animal leaps in front of our car. But what if the animal hurls itself right into our car while you're driving? That's what happened to a Virginia man when a barred owl with a wingspan of 4 feet flew through the open passenger window. Jim Crobley doesn't normally freak out, but he was freaking out. Worried the creature would start flailing around in his BMW, he kept an eye on it, but it twitched in pain briefly and fell silent. Only when he arrived home did he see it was an owl, not a hawk, and his wife convinced him to move the animal, still alive, to a box with a blanket and called for help. They called the Raptor Conservatory of Virginia and spoke to Kent Knowles, the founder of the organization who has rehabilitated and handled owls, hawks, and eagles for over 20 years. One of the group's fine volunteers was dispatched, and she drove immediately to Lake Jackson outside Manassas on a Sunday evening to pick up the bird and bring him to their office 30 miles away in Falls Church. In the meantime, the couple, both amateur bird watchers, were told the owl was likely in shock and might not make it through the next hour. They kept the room dark, but checked for signs of breathing every 5 minutes, and were delighted after some time the owl was moving its neck back and moving around. The next day, Kent told Croby, who named the owl Beamer, for the BMW he collided to, that the bird had broken both wings, something the raptor expert had rarely ever seen. A surgeon was scheduled to take x-rays to see if anything could be done to save him. The owl should have been named Lucky because of the location of the three fractures happened to be between the joints rather than an elbow or shoulder, which signaled that surgery could move forward. The veterinarian set three pins in the wings and helped him to recover in a small cage that would confine the animal's movements. We work with a really great veterinarian who has been doing raptor surgery for over 25 years, and he donates all of his time and services. Grabby Harsninson, executive director of the Raptor Conservancy, told Good News Network, "He does a fantastic job, so we're very lucky, and this bird was very fortunate that we could take him to this vet." After he regained in his full extension in his wings, Beamer spent 7 months in the flight cage and proved his hunting skills were back to normal. At the same time, the rescue group received several baby owls that had been orphaned, and to Beamer was assigned to become the Siraj parent. He taught them vocalization and hunting skills, while the fled linings implemented on a member of their own species. Finally, in late June, Beamer was ready to be released back into the wild. When they learned that Kobli lived on a lake with woodland surroundings, Ms. Hunchin volunteered to release him in the couple's own backyard. Neighbors donated money to the conservancy to help pay for Beamer's treatment. You can learn how to contribute or volunteer on their website here. And you can just go to www.goodnewsnetwork.org and find the link, Owl Flies Into Moving Car Window Breaks Both Wings. Here is the amazing video, courtesy of YouTube. Courtesy of the Good News Network. And you'll be able to hear about this owl. Prepare to be amazed.
Not sure if it's male or female, but you see the large dark eyes. These are birds. You'll hear them in the woods all the time. They are formidable hunters. You can see these nice talons here, very sharp, very powerful legs. Where I'm holding is around the thighs. It's the safest place for me to be holding them so that I can't hurt them, but it's also where all their muscles are for driving those talons closed. All right, ready? One,
Two. 100.3 Sound FM, CKMS, Radio Waterloo. This is the Aleem Show with Talkative Aleem here. So this is what we were speaking about in regards to Beamer's treatment, where the community all got together to help this one lovely owl.
Hi, owl.
And today, we're also going to have a special guest. His name is Kiro Barros. It's a pre-recorded interview as well. Let me just pull this up here. So I'm just going to pull up Kiro Barros. Let me see if I can find this. Here is Kiro Barros, the Guardian Beast, and he will be our special guest today. So let's say hello to Kiro Barros.
It's Aleem here, and today I'm going to introduce you to my best friend, Kiro Barros, the Guardian Beast. Kiro Barros, the Guardian Beast, was off of the show Cardcaptors, and this is a talking plush toy. So, Kiro Barros, will you introduce yourself?
I'm Kiro Barros, the Guardian Beast.
And what do you sense, Kiro Barros?
I sense a black card.
And what do we need to capture, Kiro Barros?
We gotta capture some cards.
So, who do you want to choose to be your card captor? On Facebook.
I know you, the Guard Captor.
So there you have it, everyone. This is Kiro Barros, the Guardian Beast, and he has chosen everyone on my Facebook to be your car captor. So there you have it. This is Kiro Barros, the Guardian Beast, and he says bye-bye for now. And he wants to thank you for listening to his video and introduction. Have yourselves a great day. Bye.
So that was Kiro Barros, the Guardian Beast. He was a special guest, and I pre-recorded this on June 2nd. So I decided to publicly air his visit here today. Sound FM. Kiro Barros is a plush talking toy that I have, and he's off of the show Cardcaptors, if anybody has ever seen the anime show Cardcaptors. Now I will go, and we are going to play the song called Waiting on the World to Change by John Mayer. It's 100.3 Sound FM, CKMS Radio Waterloo. Let me just pull up as well about Jane Elliott, the Blue Eyes, Green Eyes Experiment. I'm going to go ahead and pull that up here. And then we'll just go from there. We'll be talking about this afterwards. So this is why I'm getting everything loaded up here. So just one moment. My internet here is just a little bit slow here, so just one moment and we'll get all this taken care of. Just a quick moment. I'm just going to go ahead and pull this up. So just one moment. We're just going to get all this done. 100.3 Sound FM, CKMS Radio, Waterloo. So there you have it. That was John Mayer, Waiting on the World to Change. You're listening to 100.3 Sound FM, CKMS Radio Waterloo on the Aleem Show today. And I gotta say that we need to work on finding ways to change our world for the better. Not for the worse, but for the better. It seems as though we always hear about the worst stories in the world. And I am going to pulled up here. Just one moment. I'm just just pulling some stuff up here, and I'm also just wanting to talk about the fact that I also want to go ahead and I want to talk about how can we be more kind as members of the public. And I will be interviewing Jane Elliott tomorrow from 12 to 2. It will be a pre-recorded interview, which I will release tomorrow. I want to ask everyone that if anyone has any questions, and I mean any questions about the work she does, please, please, please email me at anathu169@gmail.com or radioalim, RadioAlim at outlook.com. Please, please, please. Please, please, please email me with your questions that you want me to ask Jane Elliott. It is very important and imperative that we go ahead and we get this all taken care of on that. And I'm just going to go ahead and I'm just going to get all this completed. Just bear with me here for one moment. And then we're going to go ahead and we're going to just checking if there's anything I need to address. Nope, no fan mail today. I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to just get some stuff completed here. So just bear with me here while I get just updating something here. So just bear with me here. Just one moment here. Sorry about not being prepared today. Just one quick moment here. So if I go to my post. Okay, so there we have it. I just wanted to say here that okay, so there you have it. So now I'm going to go ahead, I'm going to play the experiments here. The How Racist Are You? Jane Elliott's Brown and Blue Eye Experiment. This is 100.3 Sound FM, CKMS, Radio Waterloo.
America in 1968 was a segregated country. Black Americans were dying, battling for their basic civil rights. When Martin Luther King was assassinated, it had a profound effect on Jane Elliott. She was determined to find a way to show her 8-year-old pupils what was wrong with racism.
Did they know how to feel? I mean, just like Harvard again? No, I don't think you know how that felt unless you had been
there,
would you?
She wanted them to understand how discrimination by something as arbitrary as eye color is unfair and illogical, as it is to discriminate on the basis of skin.
people today by the color of their eye.
I watch what had been wild, cooperative, wonderful, thoughtful children turn into nasty, vicious, discriminating little third graders. They were ghastly.
When you do this exercise in a kind way, people think you're weak and they do not listen. Do I have your attention? Yeah, do I have your attention? Oh yeah, damn right. And I intend to have your attention because there's nothing polite about racism. The purpose of this exercise is to let these nice blue-eyed white folks find out how it feels to be something other than white in the UK for 2.5 hours. They are not going to like it because I don't like them. They've already been abusive. They've already been belligerent. They've already tried to make a joke of something. Can you make a joke of racism?
No.
No, I didn't think so. Can you make a joke of racism? Can you make a joke of racism? Let me put it this way. You laugh and I'll change the color of your eyes so in fast you won't know what hit you. You got it? You get angry about racism?
Me? Yeah.
Yeah, all the time. You do? All the time? Yeah. Why? Is there something wrong with you?
No.
No? Is there something wrong with racists?
Yes.
Damn right. If you want to see a decrease in the level of racism in your society, first thing you have to do is let white people find out how it feels to be on the receiving end of it.
Jane Elliott's abrasive style is not to everyone's taste. Over the years, it has been criticized as bullying. How do you feel about Jane's style and approach?
This is an educator, a teacher, trying to teach these people what it is like to feel discriminated against.
Something's been incredibly important to her in her personal life and in her role as a teacher. And she's saying, with this, I can powerfully demonstrate to a set of people what it's like to be the victim of racism and discrimination.
But brown-eyed adults are much tougher to bring into line than children. And Jane Elliott's style soon hits a nerve with some of the white volunteers.
What they learn today, they will either leave in this room or take out of them this room in a very positive way.
But these people are people. You're assuming that they're racist. You're assuming they've got lessons to learn. You know, we could be racist.
Oh, I'm sure you are. I'm sure every person in this room, you didn't listen to me.
You're assuming they've got a racist attitude just because of no.
I think logic's a bit faulty to try and reduce discrimination and racism.
Listen, sonny, I don't care what you think. You understand that?
But isn't it kind of contradictory?
Do I give a damn? Do I care? You, trade places with him. Right now.
What?
Not because I told you to. That's the only reason you need. Go back there.
Yes, sir.
Some of us white folks would rather not see white folks, verbally, psychologically, mentally, and emotionally abused for a few minutes, would rather not hear white folks described in an unpleasant way for a few minutes. Did you get that lesson? Did you get that message? Now, if you consider this exercise too evil for you to go through it, then you need to be somewhere else.
I'd much rather be on the blue-eyed side than the aggressive side.
I don't care where you'd rather be. Now, are you ready to cooperate or not?
I'm asking you if you're going to cooperate or not.
It's an exercise for them to understand this is what comes to you because of how you look. It's a learning process.
It's an exercise that removes choice and freedom and autonomy.
Did you not have a choice? I don't have a choice to be a black woman. It was assigned to me when I came into this world. You are a black female.
The choice that I'm talking about is a choice of whether I decide to be an aggressor, to be someone who marginalizes these people.
Look, wait a minute. I do not have time to convince this young man that what we're doing is all right. There's no way I'm going to convince him of that, and I'm not going to spend any more time on it. Get this young man out of here.
What do you think is the effect of her throwing him out on the rest of them?
Majority of this group are committed to what she wants to do. And notably, it's the white members of the group who are uncertain about it, and I'm happy about it.
And now another one's missing out.
People in majority positions, powerful positions, whites, for example, don't see there's a problem with racism. And it's a really fundamental problem. They just don't see there's an issue. And this is what we're getting here as well, is that the white people in this brown-eyed group are kind of saying, look, do we really need to do this? Is it really necessary? And she's trying to convince them, and the rest of the group are convincing them that it is necessary.
Now, if you think I'm being too harsh on her and him, you ain't seen nothing yet.
All I want you to do is act white.
You white folks know how to act white. You've been doing it all your lives. You know how to act white? I'm sure you do. You know how to act white? You know how to act white? Well, can you when you have to? Can you when you have to?
Yeah, it's a good
idea. You know how to act white? Oh, sure you do. You know you do, and I know you do.
With two volunteers gone, Jane Elliott seems to have quelled the brown-eyed dissent. But back in the 60s, when she divided her original school class, she was shocked by how readily the brown-eyed group took to their superiority.
What happened, John? Not so pony. Names my eating.
She was even more alarmed by the blue-eyed group. They gave up. Their heads went down. They underperformed. Jane Elliott felt she had seen the world in microcosm. Her exercise showed what racism was, an immoral and irrational social construct that people were far too quick to sign up to. Since then, she's put adults all over the world through her exercise, and her approach has become more confrontational.
You're either my way or the highway. Do it my way or get out of here.
Nicely.
Get out of here. Whether or not I like them, we're going to let these people in here. And you're going to see to it that they understand that we have created a situation for them to learn, that we did this for their own good. And how should they feel about that? Grateful, and if they aren't grateful, what does that prove about them? They're ignorant, they're ingrates. No matter what you do for them, it isn't enough. That's just the way these people are.
The Blues have now been waiting in the holding room for 2 hours. They're about to discover what it's like to be on the receiving end of Jane Elliott's dictatorial regime.
If one of these boys tries to come at me, what are you going to do? Protect me, thank you very much. Change places with her.
So what do you think is going to happen when the Blues come in there? Quick predictions.
I think the Blues are going to stick together.
I do agree with Dominic, they will stick together. I think one person will probably leave. Get in here and sit down.
They look very intelligent to you. Look very aware. You're not sitting in the brown eyed group. Get up here and sit down. You're not sitting in the brown eyed group. Get up here and sit down.
My initial reaction was, we're into a them and us situation. I spotted immediately that the group of the brown-eyed people were looking very aggressively at us. They were looking very negatively at us, and I knew immediately that we were in for it.
Oh.
Her mission is to grind down the blue eyes.
You know what a redundancy is?
What? They give you money and you take your job.
Once they're feeling downtrodden, what they learn from this can be a real revelation.
Who's responsible for you being on the hot seat right now? Thank you very much. Now, does that teach you something?
I have to listen to you.
Is that all?
I have to conform to the way you want me to be and not how I am.
Yeah, does that teach you something?
That I'm insignificant.
Yeah, does that teach you something? Yeah, what does that teach you? What does that teach you? If I can make you, if I can convince you that you're worthless for 45 minutes, what could I do if I did this with you for 30 years?
You can take away myself.
you understand then that you understand that you are being discriminated against.
Yes.
Do you understand that you're being discriminated against?
Do you understand
that you aren't liking what you're having? You need to know that that's not important to me. What's important to me is every time you argue, you prove that what I said about you is true. That you're argumentative, that you're belligerent, that you're uncooperative, that you're uncivilized, that you don't follow the rules, that you want to have things your own way, that you are accustomed to using power, and that you don't understand. Do you?
A lot of people are totally unaware that discrimination goes on as much as it does.
I want to know what happens when it happens. When it happened to you the last time?
Wait.
No.
You don't have to answer that question. No. You don't have to answer that question.
Because it happens out there in the real world. People make a stand. It's against the law when people make a stand. Now I'm making a stand. Enough.
Don't listen to her.
I understand what you were doing. I'm just saying I don't understand why. I spent the morning with these people and none of them are racists. Just because my skin isn't black. I mean, I'm probably not a little bit tougher. I'm a bit discriminated. Yeah, I am. I've been discriminated with that all along. I still broke it. Someone knows it. I go into shops and see my shirt. Oh dear, they don't do my size. Oh, well, I broke it. Well,
you can lose your tummy.
Yeah.
You can't change the color of your skin.
Unfortunately, there's a small minority that will use the word racism to bang it around when it's not. Let's use the word political correctness. You know how you're allowed to use the word gollywog? To me, it's not offensive to you. I don't fuck bar bar black shit. What's that? What's strange is that you've got the white people that actually source of arguing that racism isn't a problem.
Yeah, the white people are defending the system. They're saying, you know, we all have to suffer, it's difficult for all of us. You know, the guy's saying, well, I can't get the right size shirts, you know, this kind of thing. And they're not, still not recognising the difference in the scale of what's being experienced by minority groups as opposed to what most people in society are putting up with, which are minor inconveniences by comparison.
So I'm sensing, do people really understand what is racism? The blue eyes are white people, they live in their world. So I ask them to live in a world of what it's like to be black or Asian, which is quite difficult to do in 2 hours. So in their minds, it's like, well, racism doesn't exist, because it doesn't exist.
Jane Elliott has carried out a controversial exercise all over the world. But here in Britain, she's met stubborn resistance.
I'm not going with all this crap you're putting out, sorry.
That's not you.
When I came here, racism, oppression was wrong. When I leave here, I was still there.
In the Blue Eye group, the all-white volunteers are refusing to accept the exercise as anything to teach them. While the majority Brown Eye group are watching on, reluctant to speak out. Do you think this is going to plan? Is this how it's supposed to be?
I don't think it's going quite according to plan, in the sense that usually by this point you'd expect the Blue Eyes to be more crestfallen and you might expect the Brown Eyes to be getting more energised about criticising them.
The Browns aren't joining in on it, though, are they?
No. I think that probably represents which country you're doing this exercise in. Whereas America, there is a strong divide, or Australia or South Africa. In this country, it's more subtle. So even though they may have an opinion, they're sort of keeping it quiet to themselves.
By my mum, who's white, grandma, who's white, my auntie, who's white, my cousin, who's white. I mean, my family is white. So the only thing that isn't white is my appearance, in terms of my mannerisms and everything else. So I play the game.
Jane Elliott now introduces a setup designed to force any reluctant volunteers to finally step into the frame.
You, stand up for a second. You, where are you? I wanted you, nice blue-eyed white people, to find out how it feels to be on the receiving end of that which we allow to be handed out to whole groups of people every day. You don't live what she lives with.
And you can't argue with somebody's experience.
No.
If you don't see the other person's reality, then and you don't face that reality, you're almost part of the problem because you don't see any reason to change it. Change what?
In the UK, the racism is very subtle. It's very subtle.
Her child learns something like this every time he walks down the goddamn street.
Stop and search.
And in the United States of America.
Any kid stop and search is a night problem.
Eight times more likely to be stopped and searched.
But
the
statistics, I'm sorry.
It's all it is. It's
everywhere. Teenagers out tonight.
The statistics show.
He looks immaculately groomed.
He's actually a rugby player from way back. He's happy wearing soppy old jumpers. He used to have his hair longer. We have to conform as well. So, I'm sure you're talking about conforming. He would conform to pick up my daughter from her school. He would not turn up looking like a throat bag with long hair, bad clothes, bad breath, unwashed, bad shoes. No. It's exactly the same. You're talking about your school environment with your daughter, my school environment.
But we all agree that it's not the same.
It's not the same. It's not the same.
What? It is. Sorry.
Yes.
Maybe
yes.
To a level.
Let's agree. Let's agree to disagree.
Because the assumption that racism is only particular for people who are black, and I don't actually agree with that. I think there's racism for white people just as much. I've been in a situation many times where I've had remarks made about my person, the fact that I'm white, that I'm blonde, that I'm getting old or whatever. I've come across just as much discrimination in my life as possibly many black people have.
But it's interesting now that the brown eye group are actually talking up. You know, the blue eyes were obviously saying, this is where I stand, I don't agree with this. And the brown eyes saying, no, listen, these are the experiences that we have had. And make in relation to what people are actually saying before.
So what do you think this tells us then about discrimination in Britain?
In Britain, you've got an establishment of power. And that establishment, people have argued the laws that we have, things that people take for granted as being fair, but they privilege a certain set of people more than everybody else. So it's not that we have one particular racial group that everybody's racist against, it's that there are many minority groups, all of which are disadvantaged by this system of power.
But you might walk away from this and say the white people in the blue eye group are just as normal.
I totally agree. There's a sense of we're not racist, racism doesn't happen. Because the discourse now is that people think, whether you're black, white, Asian, everyone feels they're being discriminated against. But what people are failing to recognise is the issue of power. And this is what Jane is trying to present, but they're not actually quite getting that right now.
But Jane Elliott is undeterred, and the segregation of the two groups continues during the food break.
Well, I'm getting drawn into something I don't want to argue about, because I don't want to see other people abused. You are saying that just because you are black, only black people experience racism. I grew up in a country full of people, there weren't any white people. I understand racism, just like you understand racism. I don't have to be black to understand what it feels like to be a black person. You don't have to be white to... You can still empathise with people. She wanted people to understand what black people go through, but she didn't want to understand what anybody else was going through. I hate people putting other people down, it's wrong, and I don't like it. It's not about being black or white to me, and I think it was a bigger issue. It wasn't just about... She made it too simple. She was separating us. There were black people, there were white people, and that was as far as she could go. That's all it was. Once you start thinking, everybody is looking at me, I'm different. Everybody's like,
nearly as many of them as us,
but in my class, one third of my class are black children. Then I've got a bunch of half-caste children. I've got one little girl who's stunningly beautiful. She fell over, scraped all her face. I admit I was slightly surprised that when she scraped all her face, it's all pink underneath. Right? Did I expect it to be black? I don't know.
So what you're saying is that everything that people of color say to you isn't true. It's their imagination. They're paranoid. They aren't paranoid. They know what's happening to them.
For Jane Elliott's final flourish, everyone will sit an intelligence test. But she's wicked, so the blue eyes will fail.
All right, people, move your chairs back away from these people, because if they see your papers, they'll cheat.
To guarantee this, she's already given the Browns half the answers and told them to keep it quiet.
For the first time, the blues offer no resistance.
Hopefully it makes them aware. There's no way to win. They're in a lose-lose situation. And then eventually, they become resigned to the fact that they have no power. And it's just might as well sit here and take it. There's nothing I can do about it.
But one white volunteer in the brown eyes is about to derail the test.
Whose test is this?
Hazel's.
Hazel's. Where's your test?
Me.
Are you checking it at the same time?
No.
Why not?
Why should I? Why do I have to? What's wrong with you?
Let me make it relevant for you. This broad doesn't think she has to check her test.
We cheated on the test, so I don't see why we should be marking it. We gave us the answers.
You didn't cheat on the test.
Then why should I mark it when I know that you've cheated?
Wait just a damn minute. You can, as a white woman, prevent white people from learning for as long as you think you can get away with it. But does that fool learn anything yet?
She's preventing other people from learning.
She's working hard at it, isn't she?
With the final task thrown off course, the division between white and black surfaces once again.
It was an opportunity to carry out an exercise and see how people reacted and learn from that. But instead, what we got was
this controlled environment is about racism, or is about being an underdog because of something you have no control over. Sometimes the system is stacked against you, and those in power may be operating in a way to put you in a disadvantaged position.
Jane Elliott brings her exercise to a close. After 10 hours of struggle, has the exercise revealed the reality of life in modern Britain is still very different for white and black people?
I'm 63 years old. And I've seen England change so much. And, you know, for me it's so difficult because all of a sudden, you know, we've got this multiracial society. It wasn't there when I was a kid, when I was a teenager even. And my kids accept it. They're amazing. I'm the one that genuinely has a great difficulty with it. I'm learning, and today I think I've learned so much.
For me, I didn't need to ever change my opinions. I walked in there as a person who feels very, very strongly about any form whatsoever of that kind of behaviour demonstrated by whether it's one of my friends, one of the children in my class, whatever. I've always felt passionately about that, so I didn't need converting. And to be treated as if I was this pariah who was out there was unacceptable anyway, so I wouldn't pay lip service to her, and my comments at the end were more how disappointed I was.
I've been on occasions where people have you know, told a joke and everybody has laughed, and nobody realised that that was a racist comment, apart from me. So, you know, so you can be in a situation where it goes completely over your head because it doesn't affect you. So because it doesn't affect you, it doesn't exist. And that's not the case if you just don't notice.
Jane Elliott has said this will be the last time she does her exercise on this scale. Having watched the twists and turns all day, I wanted to question her methods and beliefs. Jane, thank you very much indeed for putting this exercise on and for letting us watch. There are a number of things that have sprung to mind watching it. Do you feel guilty about being white?
Not at all. I didn't choose it. I can't lose it. Why would I feel guilty about it?
Do you think there are things white people should feel guilty about? All white people should feel guilty about?
Behaviors. White behaviors. Yes. But I don't think you do those things because you're white. I think you do those things because you're ignorant.
So you're conditioned to do these things,
absolutely,
to be racist?
Absolutely. It works. The conditioning is working. It has worked for a very long time.
Do you think all white people are racist?
I think if you graduated from high school and you aren't a racist, you aren't listening. You should have gotten an F in social studies.
So that's a yes. All white people are racist.
We are conditioned to the myth of white superiority from the moment of our impact before birth. We are conditioned to the myth of white superiority.
Some people who watch these events today will have this interpretation of it. And just bear me out on this. That you let these people, you brutalize them to some extent, you're very hard on them, you make them insecure. You made them question all sorts of things about themselves.
Did you ever see a lecture?
Of course not.
Of course not. Would you like to?
Let's stick with the tradition of me asking the questions.
Let's stick with this. What I do looks brutal to white people because that isn't something they have to live with all day every day.
But you know the accusation. The accusation is you're manipulating them.
Of course
not. And that's wrong. You're playing with their feelings.
Yes, and it's wrong when it's done on a grand scale in society. It's even more wrong. But we do it all the time.
People do this more than a
decade. Yeah.
What do you think people are going to say the legacy of Jim Elliot is?
Don't care.
You must care. You're doing this to change behavior and make the world a better place. You must
care. Don't care. What people say about me is of little importance to me. Did I make a difference today? Did I make a difference today? Did I make a positive difference today in the area of racism? And that's what I want to do.
There you have it. This is the Jane Elliott experiment. You can find this on YouTube. It's called How Racist Are You? Part 1, Jane Elliott's Brown Eye, Blue Eye Experiment. Find Part 2 and Part 3. And this is where you'll find that information as well. Now, what I will say as well is I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to show how racism does exist in our society. Now, I will say here that I will pull up this NYPD Stop and Frisk program. It's on YouTube. It's a compilation of news segments and video clips detailing the history of the Stop and Frisk from the beginning to the end, the way this individual sees it. So, I will go ahead and I will play this.
This is a typical morning outside the Bronx courthouse. Hundreds waiting to see a judge for minor offenses like disorderly conduct and loitering. It's a scene that plays out in courthouses every day all over the city. But our investigation has discovered that many of these people shouldn't even be here.
A New York police officer tonight breaking the infamous blue wall of silence and speaking out on something the NYPD has always denied. Cops have quotas for arrests and for tickets. And the officer says the pressure to make quotas means the arrest of innocent people.
Our primary job is not to assess anybody. Our primary job is to get those numbers and come back with them.
Why do it?
They have to meet a quota. One arrest, 20 summonses.
Police are not going to get any better. It's going to get a lot worse.
Recording, the patrol supervisor appears to step up the pressure to write more and more summonses.
He's being clear, the only choice that we have is to do it.
You're telling me that they're just stopping people without a reason? Is that what you're saying?
We're stopping kids walking from school. We're stopping kids walking upstairs to their house. We're stopping kids from going to the store. Kids, young adults. in order to keep your activity,
in order to keep that quarter.
Feeling helpless, one young man has decided to document what he sees as a crime-fighting tactic gone too far.
To get that message out, he's putting the stop and frisk videos that he shoots on YouTube under the name NYC Resistance. He has recorded dozens and dozens of stops in just the past year. Here he follows a group of officers for 1 hour as they walk the neighborhood, stopping to question and frisk school students. The stops all appear to be routine, carried out the same each time. Police stop the student or students, question and search them for weapons and drugs. Nothing is found. Cops move on and repeat the process.
The NYPD and the mayor have argued that the stop and frisk policies have contributed greatly to the city's historically low crime rate. Still, the U.S. Constitution, in its Fourth Amendment, guarantees protection for all of us against unreasonable searches. And the NYPD's own criminal code clearly reads that a police officer may stop a person when he reasonably suspects that person has or is about to commit a crime.
More roll call recordings adding another crack in the blue wall of silence. A veteran of the NYPD sitting down for his first on-camera interview since blowing the whistle on a Brooklyn precinct.
That wasn't meeting their undocumented quota, the non-quota quota.
In his first television interview, Officer Adrian Schoolcraft, an 8-year veteran, spoke about how a top-down pressure to make summons quotas corrupted policing in the 81st precinct.
I never accepted it as effective policing, or as they would call it, proactive. Be proactive. They were just reactive. When they grab bodies off the street, when the inspector refers to them as bodies, how many bodies have I got in the cells?
He says tapes he secretly recorded of the supervisors during roll call back his quota claims.
Well, that can make it a little difficult. They can shoot someone. Just keep the house open. I'm not good. I took 50. You can pull somebody over down the street. You know what? I stopped for that.
Schoolcraft says day in and day out it was all about the numbers, with little respect for people's rights.
I want to see something.
I want to go stop. I want to be able to echo from one end of the street to the other. You understand? That's what I want in a perfect world. So that's your mission. Guys need college, need active, there you go. We gotta get you moved.
We've tried repeatedly to get the NYPD to respond to our investigations into police quotas and aggressive stop and frisk policies. We've been mostly ignored until today.
But there'll always be naysayers, there'll always be critics.
NYPD Commissioner Ray Kelly finally responded to our investigation, which raises the possibility the department's aggressive police policies, with its emphasis on quotas, is filling the courts with innocent people. Is the emphasis by the department on performance goals or quotas, whatever you want to call them, are leading to bogus summonses?
Well, all I can tell you is crime's down to record lows. We've seen a little increase. Last year was the lowest number of murders that we've had in this city since we started to record them.
But are innocent people getting caught in the NYPD's widening crime-fighting net? Court data we've obtained suggests a strong possibility. In 2008, the city courts handled 382,000 misdemeanor criminal summonses, such as disorderly conduct and loitering. Out of those, 193,000 were tossed out by the courts. 51% of all summonses dismissed. If Andrea Hibbert was charged with disorderly conduct for asking 6 officers why they were questioning her brother who was parking the car following the funeral.
You wrote to the mayor's office and you said, I thought they were here to serve.
Serve and protect, not harass. And that's what we got that night, harassment.
When Ms. Hibbert went to court, the judge tossed out her summons. Jose Sanchez got a disorderly conduct charge for standing outside a store. It got tossed out.
They're just singling people out for no reason at all.
The Colborne brothers say they and 3 other friends were the victims of quotas, all arrested a few months ago after one of them had fallen while racing each other.
They just wanted to arrest us. I told them I felt it. Now I'm out of here.
All 5 were accused of engaging in tumultuous and violent conduct that caused public alarm, given a summons for unlawful assembly, and locked up overnight.
We went through the whole process and we never even see the judge. They let us out the back door.
Keisha Rivera was ticketed for crossing the street with her baby in a stroller.
A cop car did a U-turn, and like four cops of them came out the car and stopped me and gave me something.
The number of summonses dismissed by the court has exploded in the past 15 years, from just under 37,000 tossed out in 1994 to more than five times that in 2008. A 500% increase.
Half of all summons is tossed out. What do you think's going on?
And it's a lot of complex reasons for that. It has to do with court's approach to a lot of these summonses. We can only do our job.
Emails we've received from current NYPD officers suggest quota measures play a role. One writes, they constantly want you to violate people's rights and make false statements to get the arrest. Another officer writes, commands put out a list every month of those who don't have an arrest, labeling you a zero. Commissioner Kelly is unapologetic.
I am proud of the record of the men and women of the department because I know we're saving lives.
City lawmakers say the theft will continue, as they have for two decades. The added tactic is used to protect.
Civil rights leaders, including the Reverend Al Sharpton, took part in the silent march down Fifth Avenue from Harlem to Mayor Bloomberg's townhouse on East 79th Street. Now, critics say the NYPD's stop and frisk program amounts to a form of racial profiling, targeting law-abiding blacks and Latinos.
At a rally and march in Harlem Saturday, there were more calls to end the program.
This policy is racist. It concentrates the racial profiling that leads to 2.4 million people in prison, and that it needs to be stopped. And we were stepping up, building resistance to stop it.
A deep love for young brothers and sisters of all colors, but the disproportionate black and brown brothers who are targeted, we want to let them know we care for them.
Over the NYPD's controversial stop and frisk program, demonstrators were arrested last October outside a police precinct in Harlem. All of them are opposed to the police tactic of stop and frisk. The NYPD says the tactic is an essential crime-fighting tool. Critics argue they reflect racial profiling.
Commissioner Ray Kelly, as the outrage grows over New York City's controversial stop and frisk policy, Kelly announced changes to the policy today, detailing them in a letter to City Council Speaker Christine Quinn. The changes include a system to identify officers who've received complaints. Kelly was also grilled on the topic just hours ago at a city council budget hearing. You would contest those figures.
Don't ask me questions like that. You know, I can't answer a question like that because it's a
much broader issue. You're saying the reason this is important is because you're taking guns off the street, but your own data is indicating in terms of percentages that when you frisk white individuals in our community, you're getting more guns percentage-wise from those encounters than you are from blacks and Latinos. That's significant.
Governor Patterson, surrounded by supporters and against the wishes of the NYPD and Mayor Bloomberg, signed a controversial bill into law.
Just the warehousing of the personal data of innocent people makes a mockery of our Constitution, and it stops now.
Stop and frisk street stops by the NYPD have exploded under Commissioner Ray Kelly roughly 1,600 times a day, but yielding arrests or summons only 15% of the time. The names, social security numbers, addresses, and other information has been kept on file, even when the person has done nothing wrong. This man says he's routinely stopped but not arrested. He supports the bill.
If I'm not a criminal, I shouldn't be keeping my personal information. If I haven't been charged, why keep my personal information?
It disallows the use of personal data from innocent people who have not done anything wrong. They may be suspicious. They may be thought to be future threats. But that is not a policy for a democracy. Maybe that might work in Bosnia. Maybe that might work in Somalia. Maybe it would have worked in the Soviet Union or in 1984. But we can't allow it to happen here.
According to the bill sponsors, hundreds of thousands of people have been stopped over the years and had their information recorded. The vast majority have been non-white. The vast majority have been innocent. It does not end the controversial stop and frisk policy, although one of the sponsors does believe that it will sharply curtail how often stop and frisk is done on the streets of New York. To Mayor Bloomberg, this database was but a small price to pay for an attempt to keep crime down within the city.
Michelle is not very happy about the fact that his name and the place where he attended school were revealed, and I think we were invaded privacy at first.
Governor Patterson did not seem happy with the storm around his 15-year-old son, Alex.
I don't want to discuss my conversation with my son. He's a minor. Underage.
The young Patterson was picked up yesterday by police after he was playing dice with older boys near his Upper West Side school. On Fox Business's IMIS show, the governor offered an explanation.
The principal said the kids play this game all the time. This was not no money transpired. You know, no money was involved. It wasn't gambling.
Like I said, it appears the government's office is suggesting that now they're going to try and use rumor innuendo again.
Dick, there already have been public reports that Governor Patterson had some sort of relationship with a woman. Thing at Albany, the thing at the restaurant in Jersey. Question to you is, I mean, isn't that survivable in this day and age? You know, maybe it's frowned upon, obviously, but it's not illegal. President Clinton was able to survive, we all know what happened there.
A New York judge grants Black's action status to a 2008 lawsuit accusing the police of discriminating against Blacks and Hispanics. The judge ruled there was overwhelming evidence that the centralized stop and frisk program has led to thousands of unlawful stops. The first ever court hearing on the controversial NYPD stop and frisk policy kicked off the federal court in Manhattan on Monday. Angel Ortiz of Soundview is just one of nearly 10 Bronx residents who are involved in the lawsuit. Ortiz says he was randomly frisked and arrested while he was visiting a friend in Queens back in March.
This past week, a federal judge cleared the way for a class action lawsuit to be filed against the city. It's a victory for critics who say the stop and frisk policy is racially biased. This year, police are on track to stop more than 700,000 people, and the majority of them are Black or Hispanic. The mayor and the police commissioner defend the program, saying it's getting guns off the streets.
The judges on the bench and the people in Washington are certainly not among that group.
A big blow to the NYPD stop and frisk policy. One local DA is refusing to take many of the cases to trial.
The Bronx district attorney says he will no longer prosecute many of the trespassing cases at housing developments that come to his office. It's the latest blow for NYPD policy that critics claim unfairly targets minorities.
Before today, it has been mostly minority leaders critical of the stop and frisk policy. Now that criticism is coming from a prominent prosecutor.
Lawyers say a program called Clean Halls is out of control here and across the city. Police patrolling these private buildings to make them safer.
There's nothing wrong at all with the police patrolling in the buildings or outside the buildings. What's troubling is that police officers have been under the mistaken impression that simply because buildings are enrolled in the program, they can stop anyone they like and demand identification.
The Civil Liberties Union is now suing police.
When you need them, they're not there. When you don't need them, they're right there. And they're doing things that they're not supposed to be doing.
The complaints are so bad, the Bronx DA recently wrote police, "We will no longer accept trespass cases based on police deposition paperwork." The letter goes on, "Each trespass arrest will require the arresting officer to be interviewed by an assistant DA."
So what this policy shift shows is that the Bronx DA's office is concerned about bad stops and arrests made without any justification at all.
If you want to bring crime back to New York, this is probably as good a way as to start doing it.
In her decision, federal court judge Shira Scheindler slams the city and NYPD for its cavalier attitude towards the prospect of widespread practice of suspicionless stops, adding that it displays a deeply troubling apathy towards New Yorkers' most fundamental constitutional rights.
How many times have you been stopped and frisked?
Over 15, 16, 17 times.
A federal judge ruling that one element of the NYPD's controversial stop and frisk policy is unconstitutional. The Alabama News investigators have repeatedly shown how the majority of stop and frisk targets are ethnic minorities. Our investigative reporter Jim Hoffer is here with today's ruling. Jim.
It's a major blow to the NYPD's widely used crime fighting tactic known as stop and frisk. The federal judge's decision applies only to stops made outside private buildings in the Bronx that are part of the city's Clean Halls crime fighting initiative. It is clear, though, that today's ruling will have far-reaching impact on a policy that stops more than 600,000 mostly innocent people every year. It's the latest strongly worded ruling on stop and frisk by Southern District Court Judge Shira Scheinman. In this decision, she states the plaintiffs have shown a clear likelihood of proving that the NYPD has displayed deliberate indifference toward a widespread practice of unconstitutional trespass stops outside private buildings in the Bronx. The judge is referring specifically to buildings enrolled in the NYPD's Clean Halls program. In her interim decision, she orders an end to cops stopping people outside when there's no reasonable suspicion of crime.
She found that there was absolutely no basis for the police officers involved to stop those people.
The New York Civil Liberties Union, which filed the suit on behalf of those living in Clean Halls buildings, hailed the decision.
If a police officer stops a person simply because he or she has walked out of a building enrolled in Operation Clean Halls, it is unjustified and violates the Constitution.
The NYPD credits stop and frisk with making New York the safest big city in the nation. It has also put its officers through refresher training on when and how to conduct the crime-fighting tactic. But plaintiffs in the lawsuit who live in Clean Halls buildings say police are treating them like criminals.
My sister won't come anymore because she's afraid of being harassed and being arrested just for coming to visit.
You get to the point that you don't feel like a human being.
In the last hour, Commissioner Kelly responded to the ruling, saying, quote, today's decision interferes with the department's efforts to use all of the crime-fighting tools necessary to keep Clean Halls buildings safe and secure. We should note here, too, that this case is one of three lawsuits challenging the department's stop and frisk practices.
The mayor still fuming at judges who aren't supporting stop and frisk, and lawmakers who won't back gun control.
Joe and Sandra, we've spent weeks talking to this sergeant and examining hours of audio tape and numerous crime reports he gave to us. Proof, he says, that the Rockaway precinct, where he was a supervisor, has been downgrading felonies to make crime look low and top brass look good. Sergeant Robert Borelli says the NYPD has left him with no choice but to go public after months of ignoring his allegations of routine misclassification of crimes at the 100th precinct in Queens. He says the pressure there to manipulate crime reports has become unbearable.
I just couldn't take it anymore. Came a point that I just finally broke and I'm like, you know, this has got to come to a stop.
So last May, Sergeant Borelli started handing over dozens of crime reports to the NYPD's Quality Assurance Division, whose job it is to ensure the accuracy of crime stats. The reports, he claims, amounted to smoking gun evidence of intentional routine downgrading of crimes.
They're constantly changing the classification to downgrade crimes that's not tracked. It goes under the radar, according to the FBI crime stats.
So in other words, trying to bury the serious crimes.
That's correct.
For example, this incident from last August in which an angry customer fired four shots at a cab driver, a clear case of felony assault.
I was a supervisor on the scene. I made the determination of what we had. I appropriately charged a proper crime, the attempted assault one, and it was later on changed, I believe, the following morning. Someone landed on and changed it to reckless endangerment.
Sergeant Borelli is no longer able to feed misclassified reports to quality assurance. Suddenly, and without explanation, he was recently transferred out of the precinct where he had been a supervisor for nearly a decade to a midnight shift at the Bronx Courthouse.
The department needed to isolate me, they needed to contain me, so they transferred me out to remove me from having access to the complaint reports that I was given to quality assurance on pretty much on a daily basis.
Sergeant Borelli has also been hit with discipline charges for an argument with an officer.
If you cook the books, it isn't going to stay private for very long. Somebody's going to find out about it, and then you're going to... The management, Kelly, on down, is going to come down on you like a brick.
But all they seem to be coming down on are those in the department who speak out about the focus on numbers. Officer Adil Palanca of the 42nd Precinct, who spoke out against quotas last March in an eyewitness news investigation, has been suspended. So, too, Officer Schoolcraft of the 81st Precinct. Now, add to that another officer from another precinct, this one in the Bronx, who insists the books are being cooked.
they were committing their core crime, we hand them a report. Then they'll come back and try and get the complaint number, and you can't find it.
The report's gone.
The report's, yeah, they're gone. It's like it never happened.
Have you seen that? With her?
Yes, I have. I've seen it in peripheral video where the report just disappears.
How often does this happen?
This is a very frequent thing. There's a magical decrease in crime consistently.
Just days ago, this officer agreed to talk anonymously to Eyewitness News about what it says is the daily downgrading of crimes, even at times outright disappearance of crime reports.
Hello, Jeff. I'm just putting a documentary.
How's it going?
Good, how are you?
Just wonderful. No, I have no guest. Oh, I do have a guest today.
Officers quickly took all the sensitive information and files from the dumpster and secured them inside the building. Even though the paperwork and the police files were taken into the 4-0, many here in the community believe the damage has already been done.
Did you clean it up, though?
Because you're here. That's what I'm saying. I robbed the store, and I'm going to pay for something now that I got caught with the goods in my hand.
As we reached out to the NYPD, officials say they're looking into how the confidential paperwork ended up in the dumpster.
Throwing questions tonight about the reliability of the NYPD's own crime statistics. Our investigation more than a year ago raised questions about its accuracy, and Commissioner Ray Kelly appointed a special commission to investigate. Tonight, a member of the City Council wants to know why that commission's investigation still has not been completed. Investigative reporter Jim Hopper is here now with his exclusive story. Jim.
Liz, the report should have been wrapped up by last summer at the latest. The police commissioner, who handpicked the independent review panel, now says he has no idea when their examination of the crime data will be completed. In January of last year, Commissioner Kelly announced he had appointed three prominent former federal prosecutors to investigate the integrity of the NYPD crime data. The review coming after a series of reports on Channel 7 in which several officers came forward claiming precincts where they worked were fudging the books, even tossing out crime reports. This was obviously done for what?
Bringing crime down, or making, more specifically, the commanding officer of the 81st precinct appear to be effectively fighting crime.
By just making reports disappear?
Correct.
When Kelly announced the new committee, the department's press release stated the committee would complete its work over the next 3 to 6 months. More than 13 months later, and still no report. Why is it taking so long?
I can't tell you exactly, because it's an independent committee. I will tell you that one of the participants passed away, unfortunately, and understandably, it may have slowed down the process.
But Commissioner, he passed away just a few months ago in December, long after, a press release put out by the department said that the work would have been done no later than this past summer.
I can't control the pace of the work of an independent committee.
John Jewett says he was victimized twice. First by a young man he met at the bar, and then by the Midtown North precinct. It all began last March when the man he met allegedly attacked him with a wood table and threatened to kill him. Police responded, and Jewett was rushed by ambulance to the hospital. He had a fractured rib, numerous cuts and bruises, and broken teeth. The police didn't want you to file the complaint.
They did not want me to. And they do everything in their power not to.
Jewett says when he went to the precinct to get the assault report, he was told there was no record of any incident. For weeks, he pleaded with the precinct to file it as a crime and charge the man who attacked him.
What do you make of that? They didn't want to report it. They didn't want the pistol.
Do you think that the police just wanted this crime to go away?
Oh, they wanted to. Absolutely. Me and the crime is gone.
Llewellyn Davis says the NYPD apparently wanted her to go away, too. The 75-year-old keeps busy by looking for discarded items left from the curb, which she then sells on eBay. But during her hunt for valuables a few months ago, a young woman assaulted her.
She grabbed my wrist and she
But she didn't make me fall. She slammed me against the concrete sidewalk.
She was treated for head injuries and a concussion by her doctor. She says for days following, she made repeated attempts to get a detective at the 108th Precinct to take her assault seriously.
He did not call me back despite my repeated calls and my repeated messages.
The reason police officers make stops in Brownsville and East New York is not because of race. It is because of crime.
But for the second straight week, Mayor Bloomberg told churchgoers in Brownsville, Brooklyn, that the program keeps guns off the streets and keeps New Yorkers safe.
Through these stops, the police have recovered thousands of guns over the past decade and tens of thousands of other weapons. And no doubt that has saved lives. Now, I understand why some people want us to stop making stops. Innocent people who are stopped can be treated disrespectfully. That is just not acceptable. Commissioner Kelly won't tolerate it, and neither will I.
Series of gunshots rang out in a Brooklyn playground when police say a teen on a bicycle opened fire at a group of young people. Police say two 16-year-old boys were shot in the arm, an 18-year-old man and 13-year-old girl were grazed in the back. People in the neighborhood are outraged by the violence.
It went on one side and came up the other side.
The bullet hit Ariana's left leg, and yet she's in good spirits.
That's her head.
Her mother says she'll make a full recovery.
This is 3-year-old Isaiah Rivera showing me his 2 bullet wounds on his right leg and his million-dollar smile. He just got home from the hospital tonight and is lucky to be alive.
Police say the infant was grazed in the shoulder by a bullet as his mother pushed him in a stroller on Seneca Avenue. The mother saw him bleeding and ran to a nearby firehouse. The baby was then rushed to Lincoln Hospital, where he was treated and released. So far, there have been no arrests.
Well, police confirmed 6 people were shot, including a 13-year-old boy, along with 2-year-old Ariana and her dad, Michael.
Just 14 years old, Kamar Brooks has become the city's latest victim of senseless violence, shot and killed in Haven Park, where he loved to play.
He didn't give any trouble. He kept himself. And why him?
Kamar Brooks' life held great promise. Medals for track and field, bowling trophies. School brought him honor roll certificates. And tennis, a game he loved so much, he showed off his rackets on Facebook.
Still very bright in school, honor student. Love the sports too much.
But after leaving a tennis match Thursday night, he was cut down by a single bullet.
It was doing what he normally does.
When he didn't come home by midnight Thursday, his father first walked around the park, didn't find him. 5:30 Friday morning, he went back and made the shocking discovery. Kamar's lifeless body near the tennis court.
You know, I just found Kamar. He's dead in the park. And I'm like, what?
As police now hunt for a suspect, park advocates worry.
Any guns that should not be in the hands of these people. Mixed with a lack of security in our parks is a daily combination.
This time, taking a gifted life with so much promise.
He wanted to be a tennis star. He could have been that and more.
I also want to say something to those who brought their children out here today. Like you, we all want to make sure that they grow up safe and sound. And that's why we're working hard to make sure that they have good schools, safe streets, and bright futures. And that's what this night against crime is all about.
Highland State people in the Bronx and Harlem are shocked within hours of the 29th annual National Night Out. Eyewitness News reporter Marcia Gonzalez, live in Harlem with that story. Marcia.
Good morning, Ken. These National Night Out events were held across the country, people coming out to the streets to speak out against violence. And Mayor Bloomberg actually spoke at one of those events about 8 blocks from here, where 3 people were shot just hours later. Police say that 2 women were shot in the buttocks and a man was shot in the arm around 2 o'clock this morning here on the sidewalk outside of the Drew Hamilton houses. 2 people are now in custody being questioned in that shooting. And in another triple shooting around 11 last night, 3 teenagers were shot in a Bronx playground. The 2 young men were shot in the torso and a young woman was struck in the leg. This happened at the Agnes Hayward playground in the Williamsbridge section. And in that same three-hour period of these shootings, a man was shot in East New York, Brooklyn, and another man was shot here in Harlem.
This is just coincidence that Mayor Bloomberg was scheduled to speak this morning in Brownsville, which is just about 3 miles away from all the overnight shootings. Now, that night of gun violence would likely reinforce the need for stop and frisk, according to some city officials. This morning, Mayor Bloomberg stopped short of using the phrase stop and frisk, but he did pledge to continue to use all of the city's resources to stop violence. Now, Mayor Bloomberg spoke for about 15 minutes this morning at Christian Cultural Center in Brownsville, Brooklyn. He just wrapped up his remarks. This is his second Sunday morning that he has spent trying to get more community support for his crime-fighting tactics. Now, this morning, or overnight, 6 people were shot, 1 was killed, and 4 shootings. The first shooting was at Sackman Street after 10:40 p.m. The NYPD says a 25-year-old male was shot multiple times. Sources say 23 times. That man died. Then, just after midnight, a male and female were shot in the leg on Riverdale Avenue. Around 1 a.m., shots were fired on Stone Avenue and Truxton Street. No one was injured in that shooting. But then, just after 3 a.m., 3 people were shot on Thatford Avenue. A man was shot in the leg, another male was shot in the forearm, and a woman was shot in the abdomen. A night of gun violence, again, that will likely lead to more stop and frisk.
Illegal guns use has become a major problem citywide. In an effort to tackle the problem here, Bloomberg met with community leaders and clergy members Friday at Grayson Mansion. 4 representatives from the Bronx attended the meeting. The leaders are outraged about Monday's shootings and about the recent increase in violence citywide. They insist that something needs to be done.
He's also called for closing background check loopholes and lobbied for a federal ban on assault weapons, like the AR-15 semi-automatic rifle used in Colorado.
People say it's bad politics to address the issue. I think they're wrong. I'm going to try to stir it up.
So the apartment police recovered a cache of weapons that speaks volumes about illegal guns.
The commissioner said the suspect's gun was purchased with several others in Wilmington, North Carolina. And the mayor says the problem is obvious.
This is plain and simple the federal government's problem, and they can fix it, and only they can fix it.
In the last few weeks, the police find the associates, well, they broke up a gun trafficking ring under the office was confiscated, told the missing guns to men who were running in a Florida to New York gun trafficking ring.
Illegal gun trafficking. A bill is being introduced in Congress that would make it a crime to traffic in guns like these, and it would also go after so-called middlemen. They buy guns for someone else so that person can evade any kind of background check.
A source tipped off police about the delivery of weapons coming in from South Carolina.
It's a red hot over the continuing lack of federal action to stop illegal gun sales on the internet.
And he said the time for stricter gun control laws is long overdue.
The disgrace is the federal government has left some loopholes where it's hard to enforce those, their own laws, and they don't fund any of the enforcement. But if you have some of these pro-gun organizations like the NRA repeatedly says, let's enforce the laws.
Can't lift my arm too high. Like, as you can see, I move it too far, it's not too hurt. Can't touch, like, if something's scratching, I can't scratch it. I can't hardly take a shower, probably. It's not a cool experience.
Jamela Thomas cradles her 15-year-old son in her arms, her hand gently touching the spot where a bullet lodged in his chest. Her boy was one of 4 wounded while playing basketball at Fish Playground Monday night. The teenager just hanging out with her friends in the Morrisania section, suddenly the target of gunfire. She says the violence has to stop.
Just 14 years old and already a target of gun violence.
We started shooting, but, like, me and my friend was in shock. And I felt something, but, like, I didn't fall right away.
She speaks exclusively to Eyewitness News, telling me that she and a group of her friends stood here on Line of Place near Freeman Street Sunday night 2 weeks ago.
What do you remember about the shooting? Did it happen very fast?
They didn't even, they just put the gun out the window. They rolled the window down a little bit.
It came from a car driving by, nothing said, just 6 rapid shots.
Did you realize what happened?
When I looked down and I saw blood, that's when I fell.
her 15-year-old friend, also shot.
Tell me about your injuries. Where were you shot?
I got shot in the ankle, and it came out. And I got shot in the calf, and it came out, but the bullet went through, so it broke my, it broke the bone right here. I wonder how they get the guns. Who gave them the guns?
The New York cop accused of stealing guns from fellow officers. And wait till you hear why he allegedly did. Good evening, everyone. I'm Bill Ritter. Liz is off tonight. The officer and several civilians now charged with illegally selling those stolen guns on the streets. Prosecutors say the officer who swore to protect the public instead could have put the public in danger. I would choose investigator for Sarah Walsh at the courthouse in Lower Manhattan with our lead story. Sarah?
And Bill, there is no greater betrayal for a cop than this. Prosecutors say that 31-year-old Nicholas Mina didn't care where the guns ended up. He was so blinded by drugs and debt. They say he confessed to it all last night, basically admitting that he was hooked on prescription drugs and sold out his shield for a fix. Prosecutors say 9th Precinct cop Nicholas Mina was so desperate to support his drug habit, he was willing to sell guns on the street, and not just any guns, but guns from his own colleagues. Investigators claim Mina has confessed to stealing 4 9mm from lockers in the 9th Precinct and selling them, along with one of his Glocks, to his drug dealer to pay off a debt. Now, this was an investigation that involved wiretaps, physical surveillance, and search warrants. Prosecutors say that yesterday they raided Chavez's home, and they discovered a treasure trove of prescription pills, 4 additional guns, a bullet-resistant vest from the 9th Precinct, and equipment used to deface guns.
All of these shootings have a disgraceful fact in common. All were committed with illegal guns that came from out of state.
Mayor Bloomberg's outspoken in his attacks on the gun industry. So it's hard to believe, but police sold 28,000 pounds of spent shell casings not to a scrap metal company, but to an ammunition store called Georgia Arms. The company reloads casings with bullets and legally sells them online.
I'm sure they're saying, mea culpa, mea culpa, mea culpa. What an embarrassment. It's totally inconsistent with our message, and we've got to correct this.
Councilmember Letitia James is now demanding a change in the law to prohibit spent casings being sold to an ammo company. City Hall sources say they didn't know the police department was doing this. Still, they call it perfectly legal. The city made about $70,000 on the deal. That's a frightening thought. State Senator Eric Adams, a former police officer, said he was stunned by today's news in the New York Times, especially with so many violent and tragic shootings in the city this summer. Today he asked, what's the mayor thinking?
Would he like to find out one day the spent shell from NYPD took the life of a 2-year-old or 4-year-old?
Police tonight are searching for the people involved in a shootout in a playground in the Bronx that claimed the life of a 4-year-old little boy. Lloyd Morgan was caught in the crossfire last night when bullets started flying during a basketball tournament. His tragic death comes at a time of heated debate over the NYPD stop and frisk policy. At least one critic now says the child's death may have changed his mind. Political reporter Dave Evans is at the scene in the Maury Senior section tonight. Dave.
Alyssa, as you know, under the current policy, about 700,000 New Yorkers stopped and questioned by police last year. The vast majority of them, of course, young, black, and Hispanic men. So it was big news last night when a critic of the mayor's policy, who also is African American, all of a sudden supported the mayor. But today, they did a change a bit.
You destroyed me.
What time is it?
1:40.
Is that
what it
means, right?
No.
The assemblyman who represents this part of the Bronx was so angry about the boy's death that he gave aid and comfort to the Bloomberg administration.
So maybe the commissioner and the mayor was right. Well, maybe we should revisit the stop and frisk.
Councilman Jamani Williams today said last night's tragedy does not change a thing on stop and frisk. A policy that he says
just doesn't work.
We all need to empathize with what's going on, but that emotional and gut-wrenching response, we got to take away from that at some point and say, is this working? I've asked the mayor, the commissioner, the deputy mayor, everyone to answer the million-dollar question of why shootings are going up at the same time stop question and Chris is going up.
You know, it was on Tennessee, was big. And it was on his real home.
And it's tragic that it had to end like that. That I couldn't bring this.
Is that an audition thing working or not?
It's disgusting and scary.
I'm sorry.
Very, very scary.
Sure.
Because it's happening for no reason. The mayor is
that
in that
photo,
tonight.
I noticed there that he was fucking or something.
We have to obey the Constitution, we have to obey everybody's rights, but if you don't have the right to go out on the street without worrying about yourself being shot, a lot of the other stuff is not really that important. But if you don't have the right to go out on the street without worrying about yourself being shot, a lot of the other stuff is not really that important. Not really that important. Not really that important. Not really that important.
I think he's emphasizing something. I'm trying to.
Yeah, I think he is. I think it has to do more so with the stop and frisk program.
This year than last year here in the Bronx. The number of homicides dropped nearly 25% this year compared to last. Cops say there have been 111 murders so far this year. The NYPD points in part to the controversial stop and frisk policy for the decrease in murders here in the Bronx and citywide.
Guns, cars, all held as evidence, were destroyed by Sandy's rising waters. The evidence housed in two large NYPD warehouses and unprotected against the surge. Eyewitness News investigative reporter Jim Hoffer is here with more on what it all means. Jim?
It could mean criminal cases tossed out and some say even wrongful convictions. The NYPD isn't saying much about the extent of the damage to evidence, but when you see the location of one of these warehouses, you wonder, what were they thinking? Surrounded by water, this NYPD evidence warehouse in Red Hook, Brooklyn had no chance of escaping the superstorm. What little preparation was taken to protect the facility proved no match for Sandy's surge.
So what are you doing today on your show?
I'm talking about the stop and frisk program. I'm talking about Gene Elliott.
Don't be stupid. Son, don't be stupid. Get out and go to higher, safer ground. I just don't know any other way to put it.
Same for this evidence warehouse in Greenfield. Reportedly, thousands of barrels of stored DNA evidence, as well as guns and drugs at both facilities, came in contact with sewage-contaminated floodwaters.
From a societal standpoint, this is highly problematic.
Former Brooklyn prosecutor David Schwartz says the impact could be tremendous.
We have a significant number of cases where that evidence will have an effect on the trial.
Already, it's reported the courts are feeling the impact, with police testifying that evidence in some cases was inaccessible. Some attorneys for the poor fear the damage will result in wrongful convictions.
New Yorkers are often accused of crimes wrongfully, and they're entitled to have an opportunity to prove their defense. And if the evidence has been lost, they can't.
The Brooklyn District Attorney's Office would not say whether the NYPD has briefed them on the damage, but in a statement to Eyewitness News, a spokesman said, "We will continue to notify attorneys as soon as we learn that voucher evidence has been stored in one of the two damaged facilities, and will continue to examine the issue on a case-by-case basis. Meanwhile, the impact of the damaged evidence could be felt in the courts for years."
There could be motions being brought after conviction later on that says that lost evidence would have exonerated the criminal defendant, and therefore the entire case should be dismissed. So you'll be seeing these motions for years to come. Just minutes ago, the NYPD confirmed that there has been six instances so far where the court was told that evidence for a pending case existed but was unavailable because of the two sites closed because of contamination. Deputy Commissioner Paul Brown telling us in a statement that a lot of the evidence has already been tested for DNA, and those samples are preserved by the medical examiner. However, Brown states, quote, it is unknown how much evidence will end up being lost entirely, but it is expected, he says, to be considerable.
Designed for soldiers in war theaters don't belong on our streets. And so what I'm trying to do is to get a broader conversation about how do we reduce the violence generally. Part of it is seeing if we can get an assault weapons ban reintroduced.
That was 100.3 Sound FM, CKMS, Radio Waterloo. This is the Aleem Show with Talkative Aleem here. I just wanted to also mention here that today we did talk about the racism aspect that is happening within our world, and also that I will be interviewing Jane Elliott tomorrow at 12 o'clock. It's a pre-recorded interview, and I will have that published tomorrow. And I also just wanted to mention here that I will be discussing the issue of stop and frisk to Jane Elliott. I will be discussing all of the police shootings that have happened in the United States. I will be discussing issues of racism that is going on around the world, including Canada, where in Canada we're more subtle about our racism, while in the United States they're more open about it. And I think what we need to do is we need to stop all of this forms of racism and ignorance and bigotry and all this other stuff. So let's stand up as citizens of the region of Waterloo, of the citizens of Canada, and to show the world that we can do this, that we can all do this, so that we can protect our communities, we can ensure that we uphold our charter, our Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and also that we can ensure that all the problems that are happening in other parts of the world like Europe and America don't come to Canada. So, this is Aleem from the Aleem Show. I just wanted to say that peace out, everybody. And the Agriculture Show with Jeff Stagner will start off at 2 o'clock. I'm just going to go through the transition process. So, in the meantime, what I will do here is I will go ahead and I will play a song. One of the songs I am going to play here is what we say, S Club 7. Love Train.
Thank you.
2 minute transition so I clear everything up here so that you're good to go at 2.
Yep, perfect.
Anytime. See, my policy is I start on time, I finish on time.
True. Okay, well, you can put it in the menu.
This is 100.3 Sound FM, CKMS, Radio Waterloo, the Aleem Show with Talkative Aleem here. I just want to say that I will be signing off now. I just want to say thank you so much for tuning in to the Aleem Show today. We will have the agriculture show here. I'm going to play one last song called Huey Lewis, Heart and Soul, and then we're going to sign off, and I'm going to say peace out, enjoy the rest of your week, and tune in next Tuesday, where I will officially air the Jane Elliott interview in studio here on 100.3 Sound FM CKMS Radio Waterloo. And I just want to say I hope you guys have a great day. I'm going to play this Huey Lewis song, Heart and Soul.